Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Hello.
Hi.
Are you done?
I am so done.
I was like almost scared to ask, except that I was pretty sure the answer was going to be yes.
Yeah. So this is the first time I've touched a computer since 2:30 Saturday morning, which was really my Friday, when I finished my portion and turned it in for Beyond Bacon. So I kind of resented having to come to the computer for the podcast, but now that I'm here and we're chatting, it'll be fun.
I will make it fun. I promise you won't regret it.
So if I could just talk for a few minutes about the book.
Please.
The book is done. For people who are interested in finding out more about Beyond Bacon, you know, we've been having bloggers and friends test recipes for us, and you might have seen pictures and people talking about, you know, they made this or that from Beyond Bacon to help us out. And so we're hoping that helps people kind of see what kinds of recipes are in Beyond Bacon. I think it might be a concept for people that until they see the book and hear people start talking about it that they don't really understand fully. But, you know, I can tell you now that it's finished. There's, I think it ended up being 106 recipes. So it's pretty hefty when you consider that every single thing came from a pig, you know?
Yeah, that's a large number of recipes for a thematic.
Yeah. The imagination on coming up with some stuff, took effort, but at the same time ended up being so worth it in the end, because some of the recipes that we came up with are just like mind blowing. And we're working on updating the pictures for the cover. And Sarah, I showed you like a preview of it. One of the things you said to me was, "Oh my God, you made corn dogs?" Yes, we did. And they have no corn and they look fantastic.
They do look fantastic. I was drooling when I saw those pictures. Like, I'm still drooling now just thinking of them. Yeah, I mean, I have had the privilege to see a fair amount of the photography as it's come in through your posts on Facebook. And I mean, first of all, your photographer is a genius.
My friend Amy. We can call her Amy.
We can call her Amy. She's a genius. Amy, you're a genius. The photography is just the most gorgeous, beautiful. I mean, the food looks amazing, but just the photography then makes it look even more amazing. But I've also seen like the list of recipes, and I it's just so inspiring. Like, I think people are going to love this book. It's just going to be one of those cookbooks that people just go back to again and again and again. They just go, I feel like making pork tonight, and I'm going to pull out Beyond Bacon, and they're going to find something amazing in it, because it just, you guys just totally hit the nail on the head with this book. People are going to be so excited. Everyone go pre-order this book, because I am saying, also having had the privilege of testing out a recipe, like, yum, yum.
Thank you. I'm totally like swooning over here. But, you know, there's nothing more fulfilling after you've put so much effort and so much of yourself into something to get positive feedback. And so like this weekend was the Balance Bites seminar. And so Liz and Diane were in town and as well, Bill and Haley came in town and Todd from Primal Toad actually came just for their seminar. Like he flew in from Michigan because he didn't want to miss the last seminar. And
oh,
so
that's cool.
We ended up having kind of a intimate after party at our house last night and Matt cooked food from the book and hearing Bill and Haley and Todd say like that the food was good and they all pulled out their phones and were like Instagramming and posting on Facebook, like, oh my God, this is amazing food. Seeing people say that about the food that you've just, you know,
well, especially people who also are
crazy, amazing,
such
and
wonderful
talented
recipes.
Yeah.
Like they're also really, you know, talented, you know, recipe developers in their own right. Yeah. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So, with that said, I know that there are still a lot of questions that might be lingering for people about this book. You know, I've heard from people like, is everything organ meat? No, the answer is no. A pig only has one liver. A pig only has one head. A pig only has four trotters. You know, so most of the book is going to be the things that people are used to eating. It's going to be the same ratio of things that we would encourage people to eat on a daily basis. Like Sarah, you and I have talked about, there's a whole animal for a reason. Don't only eat the muscle meat. Don't only meat the eat the organ meat. It's a balance, and the book is a balance. So, what the book does though is if you order a whole pig, which we're going to teach you how to do and tell you why we think that that's a good idea, then you get this whole pig and you're like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with this liver? How am I ever going to cook it to make it taste decent? And I'll tell you, because we had ordered whole pigs. We order usually two a year. And we had three livers sitting in our freezer by the time we started working on Beyond Bacon, because we were like, oh, pig's liver, the idea is gross. You know, but...
Well, and so, also, I'm looking forward to seeing your liver recipes, because pork liver is one of the stronger flavored livers. So, yeah.
And that's specifically why we don't have a pate, right? So what we, what we did is we thought about what would be the best use in flavors to highlight pork. And there, you know, there's a lot of vegetable side dishes that complement pork. There's a lot of, sweets that work really well with lard, which is what, you know, we use for all of our baked goods in the book. It all ties together so that every single recipe is using some part of the pork that you get if you order a whole one. And it's a whole complement of food. I can tell you this is the only thing that our family has been eating for like 4 months, right? Like we've just been working on recipe development. And honestly, I think we ate non-pork meals maybe like two or three times out of a week, because from the leftovers and from the cooking and the testing, there wasn't really room for other things. And we're totally healthy and fine. Our cholesterol is great, blah, 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 you know, cause it's pastured pork. And so what I'm trying to say is that I'm very hopeful that this will be helpful for people. It will be, like you said, it just totally warmed my heart when you're like, if someone's thinking, I want to make pork, we want this book to be like the end all be all of everything you could ever possibly imagine and want to make with pork, except pate, because we don't think that you should make pate with your pork. We give you another option for your liver. But yeah, so this book will help you do it in a way that not only like helps you use it up, but will make it taste amazing. So anyway, hearing everybody come over Saturday night and try out the food and take pictures, and Bill was like, you're going to have no problem selling this book. And it like warmed my heart.
That's so awesome.
I know. So anyway, that was our celebration evening. I drank way too much gin and kombucha. I haven't been drinking at all. You'd be very proud of me. Part of what we talked about last week, like my recovery and adrenal protocol, I just told myself like I had to cut alcohol out. I cut coffee and caffeine out. And then I just was like doing only like fruits. I wasn't eating anything sweet at all. And so that was like the first time that I'd eaten sweets or alcohol in a while. And I woke up this morning sicker than I've been in a really long time. It was so gross. And I was like, well, it's good for me to remember why I don't do this. And then I went to CrossFit and worked out and could not do the workout. Like, it just, I literally laid on the ground halfway through. I was like, I can't do it. I mean, I did it. I finished. But it was not nearly as good as the last time I had done it. Like, I'd done that workout before and it just, it was awful. So
it is a toxin. That, I mean, that's why you feel good, but it is a toxin.
Yeah, it was toxic, I'll tell you. But the good news is I did go to CrossFit. I picked myself up. I went to CrossFit. I did it. And then the boys and I have done nothing but hang out together all day. Like, we didn't touch a I didn't touch a computer yesterday, and I didn't touch a computer all day today. You know, I used my phone to take some pictures and post them, which takes about 30 seconds. But we went to the Eastern Market in DC, which is like this famous, huge, open and indoor market that they have. And we just kind of shopped around and took our time and got a half bushel of apples from our favorite apple vendor. And then we went to the indoor market, and they had a guy who makes his own sausages had made kielbasa and,
I love kielbasa.
And like homemade hot dogs in natural casings for like $1.50. So we had like the best $12 lunch ever. And then we went to the zoo and we listened to the tiger roar cause it's spring and he's feisty, and it's just been a really, really great day. And I came home and I took an Epsom salt soak and I'm drinking tea and I'm in my jammies. And honestly, like, I haven't been this relaxed in months. So
I spent the whole day working.
So in a couple of months, you'll be able to have this day.
I actually have a list of things I want to do when the book is done that I haven't been making time for. And one of the things very high up on that list is going cool places with my kids. Because I don't take a whole day to go to the zoo anymore because
exactly.
I just can't take that time away from writing. So I have this like to like compensate for being a negligent parent for the last few months list. So I'm jealous, but I know you guys worked really hard and you totally deserve to be on the other side. I hit 100,000 words today.
Yeah, we didn't hit 100,000 words at all.
That's what my file, like, I've got, because the books are of two halves, I've got two files. I've got the recipe file and the, like, the rest of the book file. My file that is the rest of the book hit 100,000 words today. So,
so congratulations.
I felt like I was close to done, but I have so much left to write. I really have lost sight of, like, I used to be able to say, like, I'm X percent of the way through. I have no idea now. Over halfway, I think, but, I just keep plugging away at it. It's been cool. I've been writing about hunger hormones this weekend, and the amount of information that I have been learning in about the roles that hunger hormones play in inflammation and the immune system has just been like mind blowing. Like, it's like,
so what you mean is when we feel hunger, that's a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
just, just don't even worry about writing it. Just go ahead and you're done. Yeah. Feel hungry. It's good. Period.
Yeah. Feeling hungry and then eating a big meal. So it's like, it's those.
I definitely can attest to whatever science you've done, my practical application. I lose so much more weight when I blogged about this before. Not just avoiding snacks, but like eating until I'm full. Like, I used to think that I should only eat until I was satiated. No, when I say full, I don't mean like Thanksgiving busting pant full. I mean like, don't just eat until you're satiated, because then a couple hours later, your hunger will come on faster, for me at least.
Yeah.
When I eat until I'm full, like, I can feel satisfaction. I don't know how to describe it, but
it's just one step removed from Thanksgiving.
Right. Right. Like, yeah. Like three bites before Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Then I go
Thanksgiving without the pie.
Right. I go so much longer and so much easier between meals. And then I find that, you know, within a couple of days of really sticking to that, my portion sizes are actually reduced from feeling that full. Like, you think, oh my gosh, I'm going to gain all this weight because I'm eating so much food. But I think it's like the hormone regulation kicks in, that
Well, whether the other thing, too, is, you know, if you're eating a big meal that's, you know, 700 or 800 calories, I mean, that's a big meal, especially if you've got a lot of non-starchy vegetables filling up, you know, some space on your plate. Well, three of those is still a good caloric intake for most people. But whereas when you snack, it's so easy to down 300 or 400 calories and not necessarily feel that, you know, and not necessarily be feeling that full. And it can add up a lot faster. When you graze, the calories can add up way faster than eating three big meals. But I definitely...
Especially if you're grazing on a Costco-sized container of almonds.
Yeah. I miss almonds. there's been a lot of almond butter in my house lately. Like, my kids are both on, like, let's have almond butter with something phases. And I don't... you know, we made this really awesome dessert that I'm going to post on the blog later this week that was with almond butter. And they, like, I didn't, we have to make it again because they ate it so fast. I didn't get to take a picture. So, and it's been really hard to not eat it. So should we maybe, do a show?
Yeah, we should probably jump into it because you've got quite an ambitious show lined up.
Yeah, so today's show is basically a sort of basic paleo frequently asked questions show. We get a lot of questions, but from people who are just tackling the paleo diet or who are, you know, trying to figure out, you know, the implementation of it and sort of hit these questions that are not always really obvious what the answers are. So we're going to tackle all of those today.
Good luck to all.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Science. So for Science with Sarah today, I wanted to answer a question that I get asked a lot, and that is a question about whether or not stevia is a good substitute for sugar. A paleo diet is known for being low carbohydrate, and a lot of people who, you know, it is human nature to love sweet food, and it is human nature to want to figure out a way of having everything. And so non-nutritive sweeteners get a lot of attention. And by a non-nutritive sweetener, I mean a sweetener that does not provide a substantial amount of energy or any other kind of nutrition. And, you know, the examples that people are fairly aware are not good for you would be things like aspartame. You know, there's a fairly good body of literature showing that aspartame is not a good chemical to consume. But it's very, very common to find stevia in gluten-free baked goods, in paleo-baked goods, in this sort of move to, you know, low glycemic, no sugar sweets. And I do not endorse the consumption of stevia. And I get asked very, very frequently why I do not endorse the consumption of stevia. So I decided, this is actually going up Monday, tomorrow for me. It'll already be up by the time this podcast airs. A teaser excerpt from my book that is the scientific explanation with references as to why I do not endorse stevia. The reason is that stevia is synthesized in the same pathway in the plant as two different plant hormones, and it ends up being structurally very, very similar to these hormones. So that's only a problem if it mimics or affects hormones in our bodies. And it does appear that stevia, or more specifically steviol glycosides that are the active chemicals and the chemicals that make stevia sweet, it's only a problem if they affect human hormones, and it does appear as though they do. There's fairly limited information in the medical literature about the non-genotoxic effects of stevia. So genotoxic means that it causes mutations. And there have been the vast majority of safety studies that look at whether or not stevia is safe for consumption evaluates its ability to cause genetic mutations. There's a handful of studies that show that it does in high doses, but the vast majority say that it doesn't. So most people say that it's not genotoxic, so it's safe. That means it doesn't cause cancer. Most of the studies show that. However, there are some studies that show that it affects fertility, both in males and females. Now, these studies are done in rats, which is a very, very common animal model. And there are studies that show that when it is given orally or injected into male or female rats become barren, or at least 80% of them do. And male rats have a dramatic decrease in fertility, including reduced testosterone levels and testicular atrophy. So if there's any men out there who are eating stevia, testicular atrophy is bad. And it looks like that these effects are through binding of the steviol glycosides with an androgen receptor. So no, there have not been any human studies evaluating the effect of stevia consumption on fertility. I do know anecdotally of people who are having, women especially, who are having issues getting pregnant and happen to consume a lot of stevia. There's obviously that's anecdotal and there's no cause and effect. It could be that it's something that tips the balance. For women, especially in sort of this day and age with all of the, you know, soy and BPA and environmental estrogen mimicking compounds that we get exposed to, there's a lot of ways that our hormones get affected. And this may just tip the balance for some women. But stevia was actually traditionally used to control the fertility of women by the Guarani Indians in southern Brazil. And they actually directly applied sort of concentrated stevia purees to their private areas in order to control their fertility. So while, scientific study looking at stevia in humans has not been done, it's a traditional medicine to act as a contraceptive.
Can I ask a quick question just to clarify? When you're talking about it, you mean like stevia is a sweetener leaf that you can grow in your garden. So when you're talking about all of this, you're not specifying like the liquid stevia that you can buy somewhere or the powdered stevia you can buy somewhere or the actual leaf that you're growing in the garden. Cause you know, different people online make differentiations about the health benefits of.
And there are plenty of people who will say, don't buy the purified stuff, just use the whole leaf. So in the study with the male rats, they were fed the whole leaf. In the study with the female rats, they were fed an isolation of a particular, there's 10 different steviol glycosides in stevia, which make it taste sweet. I think like Truvia is 2 of them, I think. I might have that wrong. But so the various stevia liquids that are on the market are usually a purified form of those chemicals. And they're often a subset of them, not all 10. That being said, the study with the male rats was the whole leaf. And as a traditional fertility medicine, it was the whole leaf. Now, I should say that, you know, all of these studies basically show that the frequent consumption may not be a good idea in terms of hormone balance and regulation. I don't believe that occasionally having some stevia is likely to cause too much issue for people, unless there are already people who have a really hard time with their hormone levels. So if you once in a while want to, you know, eat a dessert that has some stevia in it at a potluck, I don't see that as being an issue. But this this is enough evidence of an effect on fertility hormones, and fertility hormones interact with the immune system, which is why this is a topic that is discussed in my book. But if it, there's enough information that I would definitely urge caution, and I would certainly not run to stevia as a miracle sweetener. I think really the body has a much better capacity to deal with glucose. You know, clearly glucose at high levels can cause its own set of problems in terms of hypoglycemia and hyperinsulinemia. But really the body can handle that much, much better than it can handle any of these manufactured and non-nutritive sugar substitutes that we are trying to use to, you know, lose weight but still get to taste something sweet. There's really no miracle sweetener. There's no sweetener that you get to taste something sweet and not have an effect.
Yep. I remember.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. Just as a side note, while we're talking about sweeteners, I remember hearing at some point about how the brain interprets all sweeteners as a sweetener. So even if you think that you're eating like a no sugar sweetener and that it's not going to have an effect on your blood sugar, your brain, some people, maybe not all people, but some people's brain actually interpret that as a sugar and go ahead and put out the insulin spike anyway, because they think it's coming. Or like, they can even come from people maybe like you and I who, you know, ate Oreos and ice cream for breakfast at some point in our lives, that we can smell a candle that's like a cinnamon bun fragrance, and our brain interprets
insulin.
Yeah, that our brain interprets food is sweet. Food is coming, right? Like if this is something that you've done for a long time, that your body can have like hormonally manufactured this response.
So, do you want to know the super nerdy technical term for that?
For sure.
Cephalic phase insulin release.
See, it totally became a real thing. I was postulating and you just brought it home.
It's a real thing. And what there is there's responders and non-responders. So there's been a huge variety of scientific studies that show that, you know, yes, the sweetener causes insulin release, and no, the sweetener doesn't cause insulin release. And what it turns out is, or at least the best understanding of that mechanism right now, is that there are some people for whom tasting something sweet causes a preemptive insulin release, and there's some people who don't. And that's probably actually related to some neurotransmitter levels, sort of a food reward type link. But, you know, I know it happens to me. And so the problem, of course, is if you have high insulin in the blood, but then you don't get the blood sugar, that causes a drop in your blood sugar, which it causes the sugar crash without the sugar high, essentially. So it causes cravings, and it stimulates hunger hormones, so you feel hungry. So that's why the more diet soda you drink, the more likely you are to be overweight. There's also studies that show that.
True that. Excellent way to wrap this up.
Yep.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope.
So this is the most ambitious Q&A ever. I'm not even going to tell you how many questions. I didn't number them. Just so that you wouldn't.
I saw you didn't number them. I also saw how many pages they were. When I was looking through, I was like, does she not remember that I just finished my book?
I know. They're FAQ, so many of them are going to be fairly short, you know, yes, no answers. And, you know, if you don't get to all of them, then we can just do a part two show. So our first question is from Cindy from Lake Wiley, South Carolina. And she writes, can I eat gluten-free pasta or rice on the paleo diet?
It wouldn't be paleo if you ate it.
Yeah, some people incorporate cheats, and that's sort of a you know, does that work for you in terms of making paleo sustainable? And gluten-free pasta or rice are sort of common paleo cheats for some people, but it's not paleo. So, and there's definitely problems for more sensitive people with in consuming those foods occasionally.
If Cindy wants to know what we do, mm-hmm. our family, maybe once every 2 months might get sushi and white rice, as long as there's no other ingredients or additives, would be consumed by our family, not in an overindulgent, oh my gosh, I'm going to fill my plate with white rice kind of way, but we don't, on the ones that are rolls, we don't remove the things. On the ones that have like fresh raw meat on top, I don't eat the meat. I don't eat the rice that comes with it. I don't feel great after, so I don't usually eat it. But it's not something that I freak out about. If we want to go do it, then we do. It's not the same impact to our family as gluten, high fructose corn syrup, or red number 40, which are the three things that like absolutely I won't ever let pass the lips of my children at this point. I also, if we go out to a restaurant that has, let's say, gluten-free hamburger buns or gluten-free pasta on their menu, it's really exciting for the kids. It's something that they feel like they can order something normal and look normal and feel normal. And it gives them a real boost in confidence to the rest of our lifestyle, if they feel like they can sometimes have something special. That is their cheat and treat. So when you say, is it paleo? That is not paleo. I consider those are 20. I do like it. I like the idea of a 90-10 rather than an 80-20. Mm-hmm. I consider that like the 10%, right? Because our rule is absolutely never gluten. So if someone's offering them a gluten-free bun at a restaurant, they get so excited and it's like, you know what, eat it. And what ends up happening is it comes to the table, they take two bites, and honestly, they take off the bun and they eat the rest, because it's much more about the idea of it for them. Like, they don't even like the bread. So that's what we do.
We're similar. I would say we're very infrequent with those kinds of treats. Like, I might make rice for my husband and my girls once every 3 months at this point. Might be longer. I think it's been about 3 months since I last made it. They don't ask for those things. We tend to do more paleo treats as our treats. And I don't do well with it at all. So I don't touch grains of any kind. But yeah, my next question is from Susan from Blacksmiths, New South Wales, Australia. Do you think changing to this diet will help with anxiety and feelings of sadness? I suffer from panic attacks as well, but have been getting good tools to help. So was hoping with the change in my diet, it will help. Can I eat quinoa? As I understand, you don't eat chickpeas, lentils, or soy milk. Could you please advise? Let's more talk about the, I mean, yes, paleo has been shown to be very, very helpful for depression and anxiety. I had anxiety attacks before becoming paleo, mm-hmm. and they're gone. So yes, it definitely is a good thing to try. And there's some ways that you can tweak it if you're still having issues afterwards. But yes, do you want to jump in with the specific food questions there?
Yes. Quinoa was a transition food for us because it's a pseudo grain. It's actually a seed, but it acts like a grain. Sarah, you might be able to explain that more. But because it is soaked and sprouted when you eat it, for our family, before we kind of discovered our love of cauliflower and zucchini noodles, quinoa was what we used when we wanted a rice dish. And I would say we only did that for a couple of months, and now we've eliminated it. Again, it's not something that's nutrient dense or I find necessary in our diet, and I would much rather get my nutrient density caloric intake from a vegetable for my children to kind of balance out, you know, that they're not getting fortified cereals with extra calcium and that kind of stuff. So where I can put vegetables in their diet, I always do. So that would be my recommendation. I don't know that she's asking about chickpeas, lentils, or soy milk.
Yeah, just asking for confirmation.
Yeah,
maybe.
Those are out. Those are all legumes, and they're problematic for a myriad of reasons, and I don't touch them with a 10-foot pole because they wreck me.
So quinoa is, I guess it's technically a fruit. Grains are the seeds of grasses. There are some similar plants in the same family but different genus, which is what makes them pseudograins because they're technically not grasses, even though they're very, very similar. Quinoa, though, is very high in saponins, and it has also been shown that it has a prolamine, which is a protein that's very, very high in the amino acid proline, of which gluten is another example. It has a prolamine that mimics gluten and has been shown to stimulate the immune system in celiacs. So it is a pseudograin that, along with corn and oats, is very, very problematic for celiacs. So if there are any celiacs listening to this podcast, eating quinoa because it's gluten-free, there are medical studies showing that it's very, very problematic in celiac disease. And that probably means it's problematic in all forms of gluten sensitivity. So just throwing that out there for you know, I'm sorry because quinoa's, you know, I like quinoa. It's tasty, but I don't eat it. I thought that maybe there's a couple of other, because Susan asked about legumes, there's a couple of other legumes that we get asked about a lot frequently. I get asked if green peas are okay, if carob powder is okay, or if green beans are okay. Should we quickly answer those?
So I put green beans and peas in my book because you told me it's okay, and because Rob Wolf told me it's okay, and because Mark's Daily Apple told me it's okay, and because I don't recommend eating them often. We eat them seasonally. We eat them in the pod. We eat them prepared fresh, and they don't bother us. So I would encourage people to follow those rules. I don't like carob. I've heard you say that it's okay, but I don't like it, so I don't eat it.
So, yeah, I think the general rule of thumb is if you eat the pod, then it's okay to eat. So we eat green beans, sugar snap peas, and snow peas, basically, and sort of similar, you know, scarlet runner beans or other sort of, you know, green bean-esque beans where you're eating the pod. Carob powder is actually made with just the pod and not the beans. So it's an okay, you know, substitute for anybody who's dealing with chocolate. Just as a caution, though, carob is very high sugar, mostly fructose, glucose, and sucrose. So it's kind of like a fruit that way, but it's very high sugar. So just keep that in mind if you're using it to replace chocolate in a recipe. You do not need to add any sugar to that recipe. The carob comes sweet enough.
You didn't say peas.
We didn't say peas. I don't eat peas. We don't eat regular peas, and we eat the kinds of peas that have a pod around them. But we don't eat like frozen peas.
So in my research, I'll say just for the opposite side of that coin, Mark's Daily Apple went to a little in depth on it. And because it can kind of be eaten fresh, it doesn't harden on the vine and it doesn't need to be soaked in order to be recooked, he feels like it's less problematic to the digestive tract. I would say, however, we specifically only put them in, well, the recipe that it's in is in a pot pie. And to me, a pot pie isn't complete without peas. And so there's like a tablespoon in a serving. It's a very small serving because I wouldn't sit down and eat like a big bowl of them. I don't think I would. I just don't have any interest. It's not the best nutrient dense form for me. And I can imagine myself probably feeling heavy or bloated after. So that's my take. And that's what Mark says, which is why I thought it was okay.
Mark wouldn't say something like that without doing a thorough amount of scientific research. So I definitely trust his opinion.
Cool.
So Lindsay from Texas writes, is the Advocare Spark okay to drink while doing the paleo diet? And what about pistachios if they are oven roasted and salted? I looked up Advocare Spark.
I eat pistachios. You want to deal with the other one? Pistachios is a nut. So, if you're on the autoimmune protocol, don't eat pistachios. If you're allergic to nuts, don't eat pistachios. But otherwise, they're one of my kids' favorite snacks.
Yeah. Now I miss pistachios.
Oh, Sarah.
One of my favorite salad nuts.
Like, do you allow yourself, I don't know how tight you are on the autoimmune, to have extracts, like nut extracts?
No, right. So right now my stress is really not good because I'm, writing this whole book.
Yep. Thing. Know how that goes.
So I'm being really, really tight with my diet until the book is done and I'm getting more sleep, and then I will have fewer barriers to a healthy gut. So at that point, normally I can handle I can actually handle a handful of nuts typically, but right now I'm not. So normally throwing some nuts on a salad or something would be okay. Especially if it's a lower phytic acid nut like macadamias. But right now I'm not having any. Okay, that's not true. I had one cashew yesterday, and I got acne from it.
It doesn't even seem worth it.
There you go. I know.
Oh, speaking of acne, Matt will put a link in the show notes. I got this stuff called Blemish Serum, I think it's called, from Primal Life Organics.
I've heard Liz talk about that.
Good Lord, this stuff is amazing. Like, Liz isn't kidding. She totally undersells the product. And I've talked to a couple of friends who have purchased it as well, and they have the same response. Because people who are autoimmune or have issues with specifically egg whites, dairy, and nuts often have acne as a result of kind of indulging in those things.
Yep.
And I don't know what I was thinking, but Matt made sweet and sour pork for a potluck last weekend, and I removed the pieces of bell pepper and then proceeded to eat the whole thing, forgetting as an idiot that the reason that the base of the sauce is red is because he uses tomato paste. Like, what was I thinking? And I was my face was a wreck, and my Primal Life Organics package came at the end of last week when my face was at its worst. Like, you probably have the same result where 3 to 4 days later is actually the worst for me rather than the day after. And I put that stuff on my face. And when I woke up the next day, I took some before and after pictures, and I'm going to wait a couple more days of using it to show the progression of a couple of days, and then I'll share it online. But It was like a magic wand on my face, and I could feel it working. Like, I don't know. Anyway.
All right. Sold.
Yeah. I would recommend to people, if you have problems, if you have acne problems related to food intolerance, don't use it as a license to go eat the food. But at the same time, it's a huge bonus to know that you have this thing where if you're an idiot and you eat a red based sauce, that you don't have to walk around like a teenager for a week. So, anyway, what I was also going to say about the pistachios is that we get some flavor extracts. And I know while I was doing the autoimmune protocol and I would really want some nuts, I would put, a couple of drops of the extract in whatever it was I was doing. So I kind of got the flavor of the nuts without the full spectrum of problems that come from eating them. So not that we were really talking about that, but it might be something that someone could think about.
It's all good. Basic paleo chit chat. To get back to the question of Advocare Spark, I didn't actually know what that was, so I had to look it up. It's an energy drink. It is purely basically a bunch of vitamins and caffeine, and one Advocare Spark, I don't know how big the portions are, but usually energy drinks are like shots, has about the same amount of caffeine as 1 to 2 cups of coffee, depending on how strong your coffee is. There's nothing in it that looks, other than the caffeine, there's nothing in it that looks particularly problematic to me. Caffeine can be a gut irritant, and it also stimulates cortisol release. So I generally recommend moderation with caffeine. But if you're not, you know, drinking a pot of coffee in the morning and then keeping yourself awake all day with energy drinks, I don't really see a problem with it. I would just advise general caution with those types of things, because if you're using them as a crutch, you know, to keep you going throughout the day, that almost certainly means that you have cortisol dysregulation, and that can cause a whole host of health issues. So, you know, if you want one in the morning because you like the taste and it gets you going instead of coffee, I don't see a particular problem with that. But, you know, drinking a lot of energy drinks or drinking a lot of caffeinated beverages makes it hard to sleep, and then and then not getting enough sleep makes it really hard to regulate your cortisol levels, which makes it hard to lose weight and, you know, makes it hard to manage stress. And increased cortisol directly by itself causes a leaky gut, because cortisol unravels the junctions between the cells that line your gut and create little holes, you know, all by itself. Cortisol, the stress hormone, causes a leaky gut. You can be doing everything else right, and if you don't regulate stress, you have a leaky gut. So that's my, like, yes, you could have that on the paleo diet, but I don't think it's great is my answer. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the next question is actually just a comment from Susan from Portland, Oregon. She writes, I love your podcasts and websites. I have learned so much and read your site every day. I would like to suggest the Allen Creek Farm chestnut flour. It is so wonderful. I have used it for 3 years and it always turns out well. Thanks so much for all you do. Have you ever cooked with chestnut flour?
No, but I do know that chestnuts are higher in carbohydrate than they are protein. So I would be interested. I don't think that someone could substitute chestnut flour for almond flour, because it's not going to have the same chemical properties in terms of baking. I'd be interested to see how it would work. I think
chestnut flour recipes on other blogs for sort of cookies and things like that.
I think maybe I would like it in like a stuffing recipe, you know, where you would put, like, we put chestnuts in our stuffing. So in that capacity, maybe as like, you know, the crumbles or the bread or whatever in that. But
so chestnuts are they're naturally a little bit sweet. So I bet it would be a good flour for cake type recipes. I get the cake vibe from it. I have not cooked with it, but if anybody loves chestnut flour and has some good recipes to share, let us know.
At the same time, if you're trying to do a low-carb paleo approach,
and chestnut flour might not be the best choice.
Cool.
All right, so the next question is from Karen from Birmingham, Michigan. I thought that I have read somewhere in your blog posting about coconut oil and the fact that there is a coconut oil that can be bought that when it is cooked, it doesn't taste like coconut. I love coconut and use coconut oil, but my husband can't stand it. Because of its health benefits, I would like him to use it. And so I'd like to find out what type of coconut oil to use that I think you mentioned. So she's basically asking, what's the coconut oil that doesn't taste like coconut?
So the one I think she's referring to, I mentioned that we use on skin and stuff like that, is the Green Label, because it's less coconutty than the Gold, which is like a first press. So that's just like
Tropical Traditions.
Yeah. Tropical Traditions, Green and Gold labels. Just think about it from the perspective of olive oil. Like, I think it's easier for people to understand. There's like a first press olive oil, and then it's very green and it's very olive tasty. And then you go down the line, and at the very end, you've got extra virgin olive oil that's been pressed a couple of times, and it's, you know, like a yellowish color, and it is less olive tasty. It's the same way with coconut oil. They're still doing expeller press, which is a safe, you know, method of pressing that's not in any way concerning from an industrial perspective. But the Gold Label is like the, you know, you know, fresh from coconut, kind of considered the best. And when you cook with it, it will flavor your foods a little bit like coconut oil. We don't so much mind that in our house, but because we use, it for skincare, we also have the Green Label in our home, which is what I put on Finn and I's skin before we started using some other products. Well, I still put it on Finn's skin. I think I joked before, it's like our Tussin. You know, like someone gets a bug bite, it's like, go put the coconut oil on. That's the Green Label. And it would have less of a flavor when you cooked with it.
Wait, I use Gold Label even on my skin. I don't mind the scent at all. So Gold Label has, you know, a higher vitamin content. So that's how I rationalize that. And then I just have to have one bottle around. Another brand that I've used that is sort of a naturally refined coconut oil is Spectrum Organics. So they call it naturally refined expeller pressed coconut oil, I believe. And it also has very, very little smell to it. And certainly around here, that's sort of an easy one to find in grocery stores. So.
Trader Joe's now carries a coconut oil as well.
But it tastes like coconut.
I was going to say, I think it's like a mid-grade though. I don't think it's not quite
it's not as good as Gold Label.
Yeah.
But especially for the price, it's pretty good. So for people who are looking for an inexpensive option, it's pretty tasty. I haven't bought it because I'm so addicted to Gold Label, but I did, like, one time I was in Trader Joe's and they were giving away they were cooking chicken in it or something. She was like, do you want this chicken cooked in coconut oil? I was like, no, but can I just have a spoon of the coconut oil? And she was like, sure. So she gave me a spoon of the coconut oil and thought I was cool. I'm sure I impressed her totally.
Yeah. And that's definitely what happened.
So I got to taste it that way. And I thought it was pretty good. Especially given that I think the jars are like $7 or something. So, but it is a coconutty flavored coconut oil. It's not a refined, but definitely I thought the flavor was better than like some of the other ones I've tried that have a more artificial coconut flavor. I don't like those ones, like the Effa Gold. It kind of tastes like fake coconut, like coconut candy or something without the sweet. Does that make sense?
I've never tried it, but yeah, I would.
That's sort of where I started when on my coconut oil journey. I like Gold Label though. That's my favorite.
Yeah, we just always use Tropical Traditions as well because it's easy to purchase. We purchase like the 5-gallon thing.
And I just upped to 5-gallon. I had been doing the 1 gallons at a time because it's like, where am I going to put a 5-gallon tub? And then the last time the 5-gallon tubs were on sale, I was like, I should just buy a 5-gallon tub now.
Yeah.
So I did, and now I have giant.
It's going to last you forever. We've had one for a year.
And yeah, I'm thinking it's at least 9 months to a year.
Yeah. But then again, we use lard for almost everything. So it's like 3/4 of the way full because
the mix.
Yeah.
I use lard. I use tallow. I use bacon fat. I use, and I use coconut oil. And I use a little bit of red palm oil from time to time too. So
yeah, we like that too.
It's good when you want that particular.
It's really good on chicken thighs.
Ooh, yeah. So there's a whole extra geeky
bonus.
So our next question is from Monica from Burlington, Ontario. It's another coconut oil question. When I bake with coconut oil, my smoke alarm / carbon dioxide detector goes off. It's usually on the second half of my roasting after I've turned / stirred the food. The food isn't burning. The oven is at most at 425 degrees. I thought I may be doing something wrong, but the same thing is happening to my sister-in-law. The only explanation I can think of is that a gas is released that sets off the alarm. Does this happen to anyone else?
It has not happened to me.
I do not cook coconut oil typically that high of a temperature because the smoking point of coconut oil is 355 degrees.
Even if she's baking? What if she puts coconut oil? I assumed that she was putting it in baked goods.
I was assuming second.
Oh, she says roasting. You're right. Yeah.
Me sounds more like coating vegetables with it or something like that.
See, my brain just like skipped over that because I was like, we would never do it with coconut oil. We would bake with it at that degree maybe, but.
Yeah. So 425, I mean, certainly there's some vegetables that are, you know, taste really good when they're roasted at a higher temperature, especially like squashes and things like that. So, but if I'm going to do something at that temperature, I usually use a longer chain saturated fat, so usually tallow or lard, which has a higher smoking point. So that's the only thing I can think of.
But it's weird that it's not smoking. She's got to see it in the air.
Typically, you would smell it or
something. Yeah. It doesn't look like smoke, like fire smoke, but the air kind of gets foggy and thick, you know?
So, Monica, our answer is no, that doesn't happen to us. If it happens to anyone else, please let us know, and then we can address that again in a future podcast. Or if anyone has, a magic explanation, because I can't think of any gas that it would release being...
So the real answer to the question is, it doesn't happen to us because we don't use coconut oil to roast things at a high temperature.
Typically, the highest that I would ever roast is, I guess sometimes I would use it at 375, but usually not higher than 350.
So maybe switch, if you're going to roast vegetables, switch to, a fat. You'll have to melt the fat in order to kind of spread it, evenly throughout your vegetables, but see if it happens then. And if it doesn't happen, then maybe your detector is more efficient than ours. I don't know.
Or maybe it's completely unrelated, which would be bad. You would want to figure that one out.
Yeah.
Janet from, I'm going to say Naperville?
Go for it.
Illinois. I've been hearing from you and various other sources of the benefits of fermented foods, including kombucha, because of their probiotic properties. However, when I was reading on the Kombucha Wonder Drink website, I ran across an article that states kombucha is too acidic to enable probiotic organisms to live. They suggest that the only real benefit of kombucha is the acetic acid and other antimicrobial compounds, which may help in digestion and in inhibiting Helicobacter pylori. Helicobacter, you guys are going to hear me say that all the time. I'm going to say H. pylori, and thus prevent stomach ulcers. Now I'm confused and a little disappointed because so far kombucha is the only fermented food that I actually enjoy. I'm very sensitive to sour tastes, and so far the commercial brands of kombucha I have tried have enough sweetness to overcome the typical sour flavor of most fermented foods. Pout. Is the article correct? Is kombucha too acidic to be a source of probiotics? Am I wasting my time and money drinking it?
I want you to geek out, but you're not wasting your time and money drinking it. Even the site itself says that it has benefits. The fact that it's antimicrobial, I'm sure you'll cover, is a good thing too. So I'm interested to hear your take on the acidity, because acidity is a hot topic in the paleo community for years. So this will be interesting for me.
You know, how kombucha is made is it's a symbiotic group of typically around 40 microorganisms, some of which are bacteria and some of which are yeast, that grow in this jellyfish-looking thing that floats on the top of sweetened black tea. You know, black tea is already slightly acidic. One of the types of bacteria that's very common in kombucha cultures, or is ubiquitous in kombucha cultures, is an Acetobacter, which is the type of bacteria that makes acetic acid or vinegar. And that's why as you culture kombucha, the 40 microorganisms eat the sugar and you get... a whole pile of different metabolites from them, one of which is acetic acid. And so it gets progressively more acidic as they grow. But the whole, function of growing these things is they grow in this environment. They're still growing. You take that, you mushroom out and you put it in some fresh tea. It's still alive. It's still growing. And you can even take, you don't even have to take the mushroom. You can just take the tea and put it in some, take a half cup of the tea and put it in, 2 cups of fresh black tea with some sugar in it. And the organisms that are in there will then grow in the new tea and grow a new SCOBY on top. I mean, that's how I actually started my kombucha cultures at home was just by buying a bottle of the regular GTs and dumping it into a big glass jar that was full of very sweet, cool black tea. So there's clearly still something alive in it if it can propagate. And there are dozens of scientific studies that evaluate the different types of probiotic organisms in kombucha tea. So absolutely, there's tons of benefit. There's tons of different probiotic organisms. There's at least 40 different kinds that are common. And there's many, many more that could be in your particular culture, depending on the growing conditions and what was in your starter culture. So that article that you read was not right. That I'm done now.
Excellent.
So our next question is from Steve from London, Ontario. And I'll just say, hi, London, Ontario, because that's where I was born. He writes, we as a family are just starting to make paleo work for all of us and are trying to sort out the do's and don'ts of some of our products here in Ontario. We don't have Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, so we find things in various locations all over town to the best of our ability. There are many different coconut milks in the stores here, but we're wondering if there's anything you could recommend as far as choosing an affordable one that is still fairly clean. What do we absolutely want to avoid, etc.? Also, I've become a bit of an unsweetened baker's chocolate fiend now that my taste buds have shifted beyond sugar or bust over the past year. I often buy it in the bulk store, pure chocolate, no sugar, etc. on the labels. Is there anything wrong with this source that I'm not realizing?
We've used unsweetened baker's chocolate. I would just say it doesn't taste as good as other more expensive brands of unsweetened. If you like it, it doesn't have soy lecithin or anything like that in it. If you like it and that's what you can afford, then and that's what's available to you conveniently, I've eaten it. I don't know that I have a problem with it. Do they not have... they're nebulously somewhere else. Amazon UK ships to Canada, right? Or isn't there like a Canadian one?
There's an Amazon.ca.
I would definitely try to source some of these more exotic ingredients like coconut milk.
So Amazon.com has like a gazillion, jillion things more than any other Amazon. And until the last couple of years, Amazon.ca only had like books and CDs and DVDs. They've just started to expand into some other products, but there's a lot of the food stuff that we're used to getting off Amazon.com. You can't get it all from Amazon's and other countries. So that being said, I mean, you can always have a look at, what's the name of the coconut? Natural Value.
There's two brands that I'm aware of that are both additive free and not in a BPA container, and that's Natural Value. They make a regular and a light, and there is AROD, that's AROY-D, and that comes in like a carton rather than a...
And I like the AROY-D because it's higher fat than the Natural Value, and that's usually...
We like the Natural Value because most people are using a coconut oil that is a similar...
Coconut milk, you mean?
A coconut milk that's a similar kind of...
It's sort of similar
So when we're testing recipes, if we use AROID, then it's going to turn out different from other people who are buying, you know, easily available coconut milks in most stores. Because you can't find AROID in most stores. We found it in our Asian food markets, but not everybody has that where they live. So... I know Thai Kitchen brand is like everywhere.
It has guar gum though.
For me though, that's what I was going to say. Guar gum has to be out. Like if I had to choose over one that was in a BPA container or one that had guar gum, that's what I did before Natural Value was in a BPA-free container. I was using Natural Value because I needed one that had absolutely no additives, because I can't do guar gum and I'm not a fan of xanthan and the other stuff that you might find. So Trader Joe's, their coconut cream, what I'm aware that they have now is a coconut cream, and they have a coconut milk that's light. The coconut milk that's light doesn't have any additives, but you can't use
it. The coconut cream, the Trader Joe's coconut cream does have guar gum.
Right. You can't use the coconut light in recipes that you find for coconut milk because it doesn't have the same fat content. It's not going to work at all the same. It's like the difference between skim milk and whole milk. And the coconut cream has a bunch of junk in it. So I wouldn't do that one.
Yeah. So in London, Ontario, I would check out any ethnic markets if you can find like a Chinese grocer. The things to look on a can of coconut milk really is for the ingredients to be like coconut and water usually. Ingredients to avoid are all of the emulsifiers, which are really, really common. So, you know, guar gum is especially common in coconut milk. If you really can't find anything, I have a recipe for homemade coconut milk on my site. The ingredients are unsweetened dried coconut and boiling water. And as long as you have something like a blender, it's really easy to make. I make it and put it into wide mouth canning jars and stick those in the freezer. They're the small jars that are freezer safe. And then that's pretty much just like a can of coconut milk. So that's another option if you can't find a good, inexpensive coconut milk.
The same with almonds. You know, there's tons of places on the internet too that have like almond milk, cashew milk, you know, all that kind of stuff. If you can't find it, I know it's harder work to make it yourself. And if you're just starting out, then that probably sounds incredibly overwhelming. Maybe just avoid things with coconut milk for a while until you can find a safe source or until you're ready to make it yourself. I mean, that's not a deal breaker. You know, there are plenty of things to eat without coconut milk. I would say, too, when you mentioned it, though, Sarah, I think it's important for people just starting out, the rules of, you know, just water and whatever else you're looking for is a good rule of thumb no matter what you're buying, even for meats, right? Like when we go to the deli counter and we buy meat, We are at this point not even just anymore asking is it gluten-free. We actually ask them to print out a label so that we can read the ingredients, because otherwise there's no way for you to read the ingredients. And we found the particular brands that are available at our deli that have the ingredients only as, you know, pork, salt, spices. You don't want like carrageenan and a whole bunch of other stuff that are often bound up in that meat. So something to consider as you start your journey. Certainly if you're just starting, like taking out the bread of your sandwich is going to be enough. You don't need to worry about carrageenan at that level. But
a lot of people can handle the amount of emulsifiers that are in these types of foods and not suffer any ill effects. So, you know, if you're really, really healthy and you know, feel good eating Thai brand coconut milk, then, you know, the emulsifiers are gut irritants. So if you're not a healthy person, then those are really important things to avoid. But if you are healthy and you're not eating a ton of it, then a lot of people can probably handle at least a little bit. Just, you know, to muddy the waters. So our next question is from Lynn from New Zealand. My children eat paleo at home and school easily and happily, but they both, especially the younger, love tomato sauce or ketchup, in particular with beefsteak or sausages. Any paleo homemade version I have tried just does not look or taste remotely like their favorite commercial product and is usually too runny. At the moment, I let them have commercial with appropriate meats while introducing new dipping sauces at every opportunity. It is a very small part of their overall diet, but do you have a suggestion for making paleo ketchup?
We have a recipe for paleo ketchup in Eat Like a Dinosaur. It is not runny at all. It is also not as sweet as the store-bought brands. So one of the reasons that your kids like this tomato sauce is because there is sugar in it, and they have to put sugar in it because they grind up the whole tomato. They don't remove the seeds, and then it becomes bitter, and then they add sugar back in. Even the healthy brands, like we buy the Trader Joe's ones in the bottle sometimes, like honestly, we don't make our own ketchup all the time. We only do it when tomatoes are in season and cheap and really ripe. And then we'll make a couple of batches, and then however long they last. And then we start buying bottled brands until the summer comes around again. So the Trader Joe's ones, the Annie's ones, and I think there's even like a Whole Foods brand.
We buy the Whole Foods one.
That the sugar grams on it are like, I think it's 2 per serving, and that serving is like 1 or 2 tablespoons. So you need to, what we do with our kids is we explain to them that that's a treat. Like, we've shown them that there's sugar in it, and they don't like pile on a whole huge amount of ketchup. They've learned to use it as a, you know, a condiment that they dip in, and they respect it, and they know that we don't always have it on the table. I don't know that I would, what is beef steak? I mean, that's not
steak.
That's not hamburger, right? That's steak. Like, I don't know that I would allow that on my table, but everybody's different. So for us, we use paleo mayonnaise a lot as a dipping sauce. There are other alternatives and dips. We put a bunch in our book that you can use as an alternative to ketchup. But the other thing too is that I think there's recipes online for fermented ketchup, and I don't ferment because I don't have time, and we kill everything that's alive. Honestly, we've had a cactus die on us before. Like, it's just, we can't, other than our kids, which is just kind of luck. We can't keep anything alive. So fermenting is just, we've tried and we mess it up. But the idea of a fermented ketchup and fermented mustard and that kind of stuff is really awesome to me. So, and I know that that's not running because I've had it at friends' houses and I've been like, can I pay you to make this for me? So those are my ideas on that.
I have nothing to add to that question.
Woot woot.
Our next question is from Jennifer from Georgetown, Indiana. My question has to do with cooking bone broth. I used to make broth in the pressure cooker because it was so fast and easy, but then I read that in order to extract the maximum minerals, etc., from the bones, broth should be simmered for a long period. So in the interest of health, I started slow cooking our bone broth. Then I saw that Nom Nom Paleo advocates the slow cooker. I think she means pressure cooker. Nom Nom usually uses a pressure. She loves
for bone broth. She does. She uses pressure cookers.
So. Either way, bone broth is delicious, and I'm wondering if there are any studies or other data that can tip the scale one way or the other towards slow cooking or pressure cooking. Have you run across any information that would suggest one method produces healthier broth than the other?
So I'll let you tell if you have any science on that. But my
I did a quick, PubMed.
Of course, you did,
and came up with nothing.
Okay. Because my understanding is that the reason that people tell you to cook it for a long time is that the interpretation of that being slow cooking is because you want to extract all of the minerals from the bones. If you're using a pressure cooker, you're using a different kind of cooking method that's still extracting all the minerals and cooking those bones thoroughly. So you would get the same mineral extraction from the bone, whether it's in the pressure cooker for... I think Nom Nom uses like 6 to 8 hours. We don't use a pressure cooker.
Yeah, so the normal rule with pressure cooker is it's a quarter the amount of time compared to simmering on the stovetop. So when I make broth, I do 24 hours or more on the stovetop, or I do 8 hours in the pressure cooker.
And I find that the slow cooker is twice as long as you would do on the stovetop. So, like, did I say...
Yes, you said that right. So okay. 48 hours in a slow cooker would be 24 hours on the stovetop would be 8 hours in a pressure cooker.
So it's not that any of these methods are any better than the others in terms of making a more nutrient-dense broth. It's just that by mechanism of the way that they're being cooked causes the time differential on how long it takes to extract all of the minerals from the bones.
Yeah. So then the other tip that I always do is add a couple tablespoons of apple cider vinegar before I start, no matter which method I use. And I used to always use the stovetop, but then I got a pressure cooker for Christmas. So now I always use my pressure cooker because it's fast.
We have one and never use it. I don't know why. I'm like, honestly, Matt, you should be taking advantage of everything you can to make life easier for yourself. But I think just like having no idea how to even get started or what.
I'm mostly using it for broth right now. I have tried a few stews and stuff and haven't been really happy with the texture. So it's still something
I've seen some of the braised meats that Nom Nom does in her pressure cooker make me a little like salivate. I'm like,
yeah,
yeah, I want to get in on that action.
I need to play with it more. Yeah. And I have like the awesomest, my pressure cooker is actually a pressure cooker, slow cooker combo. And it's completely like, you just plug it in and it's got all the little safety things and it's just buttons and you don't have to fiddle with anything. Like it just does it all by itself. So that's also, it's called an Instapot. And I love it. Love it. I'll Matt, I will send you the link so you can put it in the show notes. It's very cool. But yes, the vinegar helps to demineralize the bone. So by the time I'm done 8 hours in the pressure cooker or, you know, typically closer to 36 on the stovetop, the bones are typically so, soft that you can just eat the bones. They're not tasty. They're like, I don't know why you would eat them, but you could if you wanted to, or, you know, grind them up and put them in the garden for bone meal or something like that. That's all I have.
Cool.
So our next question is from Jennifer from Santa Clara, California. Hi there, ladies. One of you mentioned, I think it was Stacy, on a previous show that she can't eat pastured eggs that were fed wheat. My understanding is that chickens, unlike cattle, are able to eat and process the wheat when given in conjunction with a pastured diet. I've always been on the lookout for soy and corn-free pastured eggs, but never have found a chicken who doesn't consume wheat. What is the science behind why we should avoid layers who consume wheat? Should we also be avoiding those same chickens who we eat their meat? Any advice on this would be great. And I just want to make sure I'm getting the best I possibly can.
You got some science on this to explain why I get sick?
Yeah, so there's really no good information on wheat in particular, but there is information on soy proteins, that there are some soy proteins that are found intact in the eggs of chickens that are fed soy. So there's enough anecdotal evidence of people with celiac disease having issues with eggs from chickens who are fed wheat that indicates that maybe something similar is happening with that there's potentially intact proteins from the wheat making it into the eggs, but it hasn't been measured. So there's no confirmation about whether or not that's actually happening. But there is certainly people with, you know, severe corn allergies people with severe corn allergies have a really hard issue even eating meat from animals fed corn. But from my reading, there have been studies where they've actually tried to get soy proteins into animal flesh from feeding those animals soy, and they've been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So from my reading, it doesn't happen with the meat. It may be a contamination issue. There's certainly with eggs, there's gluten cross reactivity issues, which muddies the waters and makes it much harder to detect whether the difference is because there's trace gluten in the egg or because there's a protein in the egg that is also recognized by the same antibodies that your body produces against gluten, or that there's just contamination, that there's something on the surface of the egg that, you know, because it was laid and there was grains around and it didn't get washed off or something. So yes, there's some evidence that happens with the eggs, but even though there's anecdotal evidence of people having allergic reactions to meat, there's no scientific evidence to show that intact proteins from feed are showing up in the muscle meat.
And so just as you were talking, it kind of drew it all together for me, if I can try to like layman's term it out. You know, for me in particular, I have celiac disease, which makes me super susceptible. It also makes me have an autoimmune condition, which means I shouldn't be eating eggs. What I found personally is that I don't have a problem with egg yolks from quality chickens. Now, those quality chickens might be getting some wheat supplement in their feed, which should be varied. It shouldn't be like 100% wheat. I think the specifics of what I'm trying to say is that if someone is just like growing wheat on their farm or using a supplemental feed that has the majority of that being wheat rather than a variety of seeds and grubs and things that they would naturally find in their diet, my body reacts. I can tell when something is like a low quality, this chicken
has... Do you think that's the fat profile, you know, being swayed towards more omega-6 fats, which are more pro-inflammatory? Or do you think that's a trace, you know, protein type issue?
I don't know. But when I eat the yolk, I don't have a problem. Like, I went to Sally Fallon's farm and talked to Sally, and I know that her chickens receive some wheat supplement. But I came home and I put those yolks in a coconut milk yogurt, and I had absolutely no problems at all. So I think the issue might be the anti-nutrients that are going into particularly the egg whites, which is like the most protective layer of the egg, the most problematic protein, an irritant, and I think that's, you know, likely where the gluten cross reactors are. If I think that might be like what's holding the binding of whatever is happening in the chicken's body to that overabundance of wheat. And so if a chicken doesn't have like an overabundance of wheat, and if you don't have a severe gluten problem like I have, then go for it. Like for me, what I mean by I have a problem with eggs is within 20 minutes of eating them, I have to go to the bathroom, and it's not a pleasant situation. You know, so it's pretty obvious to me when these things happen. It's not like a nebulous, no, I'm not sure. Maybe I, you know, a little fuzzy headed. Like, it is very clear to me when I have a problem egg. So if you're eating something you can't, and you can't find a farm that doesn't have any wheat at all in the chicken feed, and it's not bothering you, then... And you know that they're getting pasture, and you know they're getting bugs and things that are natural to their diet, and the chickens seem happy and healthy, and they're laying colorful, dark yolks. Eat it if it doesn't bother you.
And there's no good evidence in the scientific literature for any reason why you would avoid also eating the chicken itself.
Yeah, and I don't have any physical problems eating the meat of a chicken who ate wheat, to be very clear. I have ethical issues with chickens that aren't, but I have no physical problems from that. So, concur.
Okay, so our next question is from Angela from San Jose, California. Can I implement paleo but not use grass-fed meats? What benefit do you get by doing that? That could be a whole show just on its own, but the quick answer is...
I'm pretty sure we each have, like, dedicated thousands of words in our books to this topic, but go for it.
The quick answer is, of course you can.
Yes. And there's posts by... In particular, I like to quote the Rob Wolf one, where he talks about, you know, implementing this on a budget, and he talks about not using grass-fed meats, as well as Diane Sanfilippo's paleo perfectionism post. Those are really good to read and kind of confirm for you. However, if you have the money, it is healthier for you. It is healthier for the environment, and it is healthier for the animal if you can find a source of pastured, humane, sustainable meat production.
But you can absolutely experience all of the benefits of a paleo diet eating conventional meat and vegetables. Like, there's... it's better for you to eat grass-fed, locally grown organic, but it's not a non-starter. You know, the far bigger difference for your health is cutting out grains and legumes and dairy and processed foods and refined sugars.
Okay.
Okay. So our next question is from Erica from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I was lacto-ovo-vegetarian for 5 years and ate way too many grains/carbs. I recently started adding local, organic, grass-fed, free-range chicken, turkey, and seafood into my diet. I hadn't done much research on any of these animal products. At this point, I really have no idea what I am doing food-wise. I am really interested in beginning a paleo lifestyle, but I don't eat that much meat. I don't really like meat all that much. So what I'm wondering is it possible to be a vegetarian and paleo at the same time? So no meat, no dairy, no gluten. Well, I guess anything is possible, but would it be successful and would I be getting enough nutrients? I remember hearing one of you was a vegetarian for 7 years, so how was it reintroducing meat into your diet?
So, Erica,
for you. Yeah,
Erica from Minneapolis, I would ask you why you're a vegetarian. It sounds like if you started adding meat in that you were either craving it or you don't have an ethical problem. And I would say both of those would indicate to me that it's a worthwhile effort for you to get your nutrients from your protein in particular. It's a complete protein without a huge amount of carbohydrate when you get it from something with a face. So, I would suggest that as you transition, you eat things. Seafood in particular was not problematic at all for me when I started migrating. What's going to happen to your diet, though, and probably what's going to happen to you, not your diet, and probably the reason that you don't like meat is probably a stomach acid issue. Once you haven't used the stomach acid in your system for so long, 5 years being so long, your body forgets how to properly digest it, which means it's not something that your body wants. When it comes to you, your body knows it can't handle it, and so the idea of it doesn't sit well with you. In that case, I would say, there are a couple of things you can do. I take a HCl, honestly, I think that's hydrochloric something.
Yeah,
acid. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. I also take ox bile, but that has nothing to do with what your needs are before every meal. You can also drink lemon water. You can drink apple cider vinegar. There are a couple of natural ways to increase the acid in your stomach to help ease the digestion of the meat as you start to incorporate it into your diet. As your stomach acid increases, you'll probably find that meat is more appealing to you. I would say most of the vegetarians that I know have difficulty regulating carbohydrate intake because any of the proteins that you get are also accompanied by carbohydrate. So that can lead to insulin problems. It can lead to blood sugar regulation in general, just if you're not getting, the proper amount of fat, probably because we recommend that you eat saturated fat from animal products. There's only so much avocado you can eat, and coconut oil, I guess. The answer to my question would be, I don't believe that you can be an ovo-lacto vegetarian and successfully paleo at the same time. If you are willing to incorporate eggs and fish, you're going to be a lot closer to that. And hopefully over time, you will find room in your diet for occasional grass-fed ruminants and things that offer nutrient profiles dense in your diet that you can't get anywhere else. You don't want to be B12 and K2 deficient. And if you're an ovo-lacto vegetarian, you likely are.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly do it with fish and seafood, especially if you're eating, shellfish like oysters and mussels. But just with eggs, I think you're missing out a lot of nutrients that you would be getting from meat and seafood.
This next question's a doozy.
Yeah, but it's perfect. This next question, the doozy, is from Suzanne from San Francisco, California. Could you please discuss pork and whether it is safe to eat? Is the controversy about eating pork related to the animal itself and parasites that it inherently carries, or is it because of the way pigs are raised? Do all pigs carry parasites, or only ones raised in certain ways? I haven't eaten pork in many years, but now I am on the autoimmune protocol. I would like to find out if it is safe to try, as I would like to add more variety to my diet. Thank you, and I love your show. You have both educated me about many different paleo topics.
So, Sarah, you gave a little preview to your book earlier. I guess I'm going to have to give a little preview to our book. We address pork in depth in Beyond Bacon, and we did extensive research on pork in doing that. The reason that pigs are prone to parasites is because they're omnivores. They eat anything. So, when they're in the forest rooting around, even pastured pork raised ethically and correctly can pick up worms or parasites that can be problematic. that isn't a problem if you're cooking it through all the way, and then the worms and bacteria and parasites wouldn't survive, or you're marinating your meat in some sort of acidic fashion that would also kind of kill off any sort of living things in there. However, the idea that pink pork is a problem came about 20 years ago when porks were being fed leftover animal products from farmers that had sick animals that died. They would give the pigs the raw meat because pigs eat everything. And
I just want to say that's gross.
It's disgusting. And it's no longer happening. But there were a lot of outbreaks of I don't remember what it is. Matt did the research and we've got the information, the references in Beyond Bacon, but there was some sort of health issue that broke out and it was all traced back to, at that time, pork. And what they realized is that by giving these pigs dead, sick animals, the pigs were getting sick. Shocker. You know, so then if you're not cooking your meat all the way through, those parasites were still in that meat that people were buying and eating of the sick pigs because they ate the sick animals and it was passing through to that person and then that person would get sick. So, what's happened now is that the USDA comes in and regulates what these animals can and can't eat. And they're not allowed to eat other dead, sick animals anymore, thankfully. And that outbreak of what happened, I'm sure it'll be in the show notes if you want more information, because we have all the information, went down to practically zero on a pork-related thing. That sickness, I don't know if it's a virus or parasite or something, but it actually still exists because people are eating game animals and stuff that who knows what that like deer ate from a hunter and then maybe that hunter gets sick. It still exists. But when it comes to like farmed and pastured or even calf or raised pigs, that isn't happening anymore. So the USDA, I think
there,
it was
trichinosis.
Thank you.
The wonders of the internet.
Thank you, Sarah.
I can't also
Google, so you be my multi.
I'm the Google.
At that time, 20 years ago, I think it was the USDA that put out the recommendation to cook your pork well done. And the reason that they did that was because they didn't quite know what it was or how to trace it back, but they knew that if you cooked your meat well done, then you wouldn't have this problem. Since then, they have kind of repealed their thought on that because we've solved the trichinosis problem. And you can go to actually public websites, you know, run by the government that say the recommended temperatures to cook pork. And you'll see that the recommendations to cook pork chops and roasts and things that aren't ground meat and things that aren't smoked and grilled, which obviously, or braised meats you would be cooking for longer, they recommend, and well, they say that you can cook it to pink, essentially, which is what we recommend in our book. Like, we find a tenderloin and pork chops much more tasty when it's basically like a medium well for pork. And the reason that that's safe is because trichinosis isn't, it's highly unlikely, just the same way that, you know, you could get salmonella from a raw egg, but it's very uncommon, especially in pastured eggs, is basically now like the same equivalent to, or even less of a commonality than trichinosis is to pork. In addition to that, there's also some information floating around on Mercola and the Weston A. Price Foundation's website about a blood slide analysis that was done on three volunteers who ate pork in different ways, one being marinated, one being cured being like salt cure, like a bacon, and one being just if it was raw, unmarinated, and then you cooked it and ate it. So they found in this study with three people on blood slide analysis, which no scientific journal or overarching entity of any kind would ever recognize as a legitimate study because there's too many variables. It's too open to interpretation from the person performing it. And there's too little participants in the study to be able to prove that something is happening, right? Like the larger a study, the more effective it is. So this study that they did with these three people found that the one person who ate the pork chop without it being marinated had thicker blood afterwards. And what they deducted was, then you shouldn't eat pork because it'll do bad things to your blood. Well, Sarah, I asked you to take a look at the study because our interpretation was that it wasn't a legitimate study. And you helped us.
I got riled up.
You did. And it's so awesome. We got a quote from you for the book about why that kind of scientific study isn't effective. And also why even just 2 extra seconds on a blood slide, like if the person blinked before they put it under the microscope and looked at it really quickly, would show that the blood had thickened because it's sitting out under the air and that could thicken blood. It's blood slide analysis is completely ineffectual and isn't used in the scientific community at all. So
yeah. I did quite a fairly extensive research on the merits of live blood analysis, because it's also a technique that's used by a lot of alternative healthcare practitioners as a diagnostic tool for some people. And I'd have been asked about it before. And there have been studies done on live blood analysis that show that it is incredibly subjective, that you give the same slides to 10 different people and they'll come up with 10 different interpretations of the results. And it's very, very subjective to artifacts of slide preparation. So depending on exactly how big your drop of blood is, what part of the slide is put on, exactly how the cover slide is placed on top, exactly how much time there is in between that, exactly how much time there is between it's put on the slide, can completely change how that blood looks under a microscope. And microscopy is something that I am extremely familiar with because I have personally logged thousands and thousands of hours using every kind of microscope that is used as a tool in medical research. So I, you know, completely understand the variability and a measurement technique that introduces its own variability. There's enough variability between individuals on its own. A measurement technique that introduces its own variability is not at all useful in science. And so it's a technique that is not used at all in scientific research, and it is not used at all in the medical profession, including by medical professionals, you know, of blood, like including the people who specialize in analyzing blood and looking for blood disorders. So, it's just not a valid study.
So to answer your question from a completely biased perspective on the people that wrote the book about how to eat pork, we think it's perfectly safe to eat.
Yes. And yummy.
And delicious. And if you're even remotely worried about it, if it is something that we haven't addressed thoroughly for you, there is absolutely no literature anywhere at all that supports eating pork that is unmarinated, no literature that supports that if you eat marinated or cured pork, that it is remotely problematic. Every single article and study, I mean, other than the saturated fat topic, which we also address in Beyond Bacon, but that's not for today's show, about pork in particular, if you're marinating it or if you're curing it, it addresses any of the concerns that Mercola, Weston A. Price Foundation, or Trigonosis brings up.
Okay.
But we suggest that you eat pink pork chops. Because they're delicious.
Okay. We've got 2 more quick questions. So let's try and squeeze them in. I know this is another long show, although I don't think we can break the record from last week yet. Paula from Owen Sound, Ontario, Canada. And just, I want to say, like, awesome that we're getting so many, you know, Canadian questions today.
Shout out to Alex Boak, by the way. She is also Canadian. And she listened to our podcast for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And she likes you because you're bonded. So
it's the Canadian bond. We say sorry a lot.
You all know each other, right?
Of course, because there's only like 6 of us. Yeah. All right. Hi, I just purchased a Nesco dehydrator and I am really enjoying drying foods. I've been searching for a good book for recipes and ways to use dehydrated foods following the paleo lifestyle. Would you be so kind as to recommend one? Thank you.
Paula, I recommend you purchase Eat Like a Dinosaur, written by the paleo parents. It includes many dehydrated recipes following the paleo lifestyle.
I actually don't know of any other books to recommend. Whenever I want to dehydrate something new, I just go on the Google and I go strawberry dehydrator recipe and then see what comes up. I don't have any other suggestions.
I'm sure Nesco put something out, but it's not going to be paleo. So if you're looking for recipe book in particular,
that comes with, because I think she bought the same dehydrator that I have. There's a recipe book that comes with it that has general guidelines. Some stuff is useful, like general guidelines for jerky, general guidelines for fruit, general guidelines.
But if you're looking for like marinades for your jerky and then how should you cook it, you know, Eat Like a Dinosaur has several jerky recipes, including a chicken one, a ground meat one, and then a regular jerky recipe. We teach you how to make some apples in your dehydrator. I'm pretty sure there's more than that. I just can't think of it. I know we use the dehydrator a lot in that book. Because people complain that there's too many dehydrated recipes. So there you go. Paula, you can balance out that equation.
All right. One more question. And it's from Lindsay from Colorado. Love listening to you wonderful ladies on my drive to work, just like I'm having a get together with my girlfriends. Thank you, Lindsay. My question
is, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt Lindsay's question, but at the Balance Bait seminar, I was meeting all of these awesome, wonderful people who are so nice and complimentary and getting their book signed. And every single person, well, okay, first of all, half of them asked me if I was Sarah, which was just kind of awkward because I'm like, nope, we're separate people. We live in different states. but
we have similar voices. I could totally understand that people would mix up which one of us is which.
I made the joke to a couple people. I'm like, you can always tell by asking us to say avocado because then you'll know. So a whole slew of people were really complimentary, talking about how much they love the podcast. And it was kind of like a blushing moment because I'm sitting next to Diane, who's like awesome and fantastic and genius, and we love her podcast and we love her, and she's signing books and I'm sitting next to her signing books, and people are like, I love your podcast. And I'm like, how could you even like say that in Diane's presence? Because like, I love Diane's podcast. So it was really cool to me that they clearly are enjoying the podcast. And so thank you to everyone who was so nice. If I was at all rude or short or kind of glazed over, it was because I had been up until 3 o'clock in the morning, turning in Beyond Bacon. And I was really just overwhelmed. And I appreciate everyone's kindness now that I've had some time to reflect on it. So, all right, Lindsay, sorry.
Okay. Her question is, my daughter had a severe reaction when we gave her fermented cod liver oil. She broke out in body hives for 3 days with severe itching. We have had her blood tested for food allergies, and cod and salmon came up as a moderate food allergy. Do you have any suggestions for something to do in place of the FCLO?
I don't know. What are you going to recommend?
I'm going to recommend incorporating organ meat. Mm. I mean, the reason why FCLO is so magical is seafood is naturally high in vitamin D, and the only other meats that are really naturally high in vitamin D is basically liver from land animals, and it's also very high in vitamin A, which also you find in really good quantities in land animals. And then it's fermented, so you get sort of the probiotic aspect, you get the metabolites of those bacteria, which are largely unknown. So actually, we don't really know what all the good stuff is in FCLO. And then you also get long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. So you kind of get this like perfect blend of really dense vitamins. You get A and D and K2 in particular, which are all really, really essential for bone health. And then you get the probiotic aspect, and then you get the omega-3 aspect. So, you know, those are all things you can get from other foods. You don't need to do a fermented cod liver oil supplement. So you can get that from eating fish and seafood that your daughter's not allergic to, if there is any. I mean, I don't, you know, often fish and shellfish allergies are the kind where it's kind of like, if you're allergic to one nut, your chances are you're allergic to all nuts. Fish and shellfish allergies are kind of like that too. So I would be cautious with that. But getting some organ meat and getting a variety of different organ meat from other animals, other food sources of vitamin D is basically mushrooms. But then there's the sun, which is a great source of vitamin D. So I highly recommend sun. And if you're getting some fermented foods in another way, whether it's making your own homemade coconut milk yogurt or kefir or fermented vegetables, we already talked about fermented ketchup, you know, any of those sorts of foods, or you could even go as far as a probiotic supplement if you wanted to. Although if your daughter's healthy, I don't think there's any really strong reason to do that. Just let her play in the dirt. So, you know, it's a great supplement, but you can get all of those nutrients in other places. It's not like it's completely unique in the, you know, food or world. So, yeah, I would just work on incorporating some organ meat into your life.
I don't know why I didn't realize if that's what you were going to say. I was like, I don't know. I mean, if they can't have fish, what else? Like, duh. Yeah. Good one.
I'm pro awful. So.
Me too. Awful is not awful.
Nope. That's what I named my stew.
That's what the show, that's what the name of our show should be.
Awful, but
organ meats, sunlight, and sleep. Okay. Well, it was a great show. I am going to decompress and relax again now that I'm all whipped up from the podcast.
I know. I always end up so jazzed when we finish recording.
Yeah.
But I'm going to try and go to bed and sleep with the time difference, like, because tomorrow morning is going to hurt if I don't at least try.
Yep.
So, nice chatting with you.
Ditto, m'lady.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Wait, Matt, you're going to have to edit this out now because you're tapping a jar while I'm trying to talk. Okay, it might be a little lengthy, that one, right?
It could be, it depends. It's all you. I'm not going to add anything.
Oh, come on.
Oh, well, maybe.